listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of XOXO Tavi by Kenzie Bryant. A week after our conversation, she sent me an email explaining how she was thinking about the essay's reception, especially with regard to the ask of her readers. For anyone to defy the terms would signal to me that they are giving preference to the avatar of me as a victim, to whom they are prescribing their idea of justice over the real person who made real request on the page, who these things actually happened to. I was pleased my readers understood that it would be unethical to defy these terms, and it would be ironic because the issue at hand is not only consent but fetishization. From the Joe Livingston article I mentioned to you, Why Are Adult Women Infatuated with Teenage Girls, from the New Republic in 2017, we call it fetishization because it reduces these individuals to one exaggerated aspect of their identity at the expense of the rest of the person. Now that I'm writing this, I see what a leap of faith it was to publish something that makes that kind of request of thousands of strangers. So, although it was in reaction to the world as it is, I think it was also for the world I want to see. The two worlds, existing and hopefully imagined, also figured into her second essay about working with now notorious Broadway and film producer Scott Rudin, which was met with two kinds of responses. There were those in her orbit who side-eye the unveiling of a man hiding in plain sight, calling it sanctimonious and hypocritical to suddenly turn on the guy, and there were those outside of that orbit who couldn't understand how you work for a person like that, how you don't extricate yourself at the very least. She saw a chance to draw those poles to each other, explaining how the dual influences of fear and careerism fostered such a situation. With that one, I was like, oh, I'm actually in a position where it is to my advantage to be both, to be inside of it, says Gevinson, the essayist who is also a stage actor, the freelance writer who also has a publicist. Maybe I can offer some kind of insight around how this kind of culture can persist, or how it's allowed to persist. Lonergan, who is among Gevinson's cast of friends, but the only one who wrote This Is Our Youth, read both essays multiple times. I'm amazed by how she's tackling issues that are really being talked about exhaustively in public, he says. What I find remarkable about both those pieces is that she's also able to examine the architecture of her own thoughts, ideas about it in such a cold, analytical way, and without ever losing that personal relationship to what she's writing about. If everybody was as thoughtful and imaginative and frank about themselves and about the personal connection with some of these big things that are happening, I think we'd all be in a much better place. Both Lonergan and Safran have three similar things to say about Gevinson, all of which I experienced as well. First is that she has no real fealty to her age group, and never really has. As Safran told me, she is as fluent in 65-year-old as she is in 45-year-old as she is in 20, and as Lonergan mentioned, has friends everywhere in between. This is rare, though maybe it shouldn't be. Second is that she will talk your way to a broadened mind. New neural pathways are formed in my brain when I spend time with her, says Safran. Says Lonergan, she has very much informed my view of a lot of things in ways that I haven't thought of, because she is coming at it from such a different point of view. And third, that she can hang for hours. Lonergan laughs about the time she slept on his couch after dinner with his wife and daughter because she stayed past his bedtime and hers. Safran marvels at the time she came over and stayed for like 8 hours just talking to him and his husband. I kept expecting her to say she had to go, and she kept not doing that. Until she did, after such a long time, after such a long while there in the sculpture garden, our bagels a faraway memory. Time, it's just another absolute that isn't one for Gevinson. Just another thing that doesn't have to define her yet if she doesn't let it. Just another thing she has in spades that she can use to her advantage, should she choose to. Thank you. Original Sin's. In the 90s, Gavin McInnes played punk rock and helped create Vice magazine. 5 years ago, he founded a very different organization, the Proud Boys, the far-right group that came to personify the vilest tendencies of Trump's America. Adam Leith Gallner interviews one of our era's most troubling extremists. Opening photo, in the shadows, Gavin McInnes in New York City in 2018. On election night in 2016, 4 years before the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol, the Proud Boys threw a party. That November evening, Proud Boys founder Gavin McInnes, my former boss, summoned his followers to the Gaslight Lounge in New York's Meatpacking District to watch the returns. "Tonight, we either take back the country, or we lose the country to the establishment," he told the attendees. A mixture of Trumpist trolls, frat bros, and the sort of amped-up nationalist types who call themselves Western chauvinists. McInnes had just created his gang months before, but as someone who'd always predicted trends, he could see where this would lead. "If Donnie wins," he bellowed into a distorting microphone, "the Proud Boys will own America. We'll just walk into the White House." They began chanting, "USA, USA, USA," the same way the Proud Boys would when breaching the Capitol complex in January. Few back in 2016 realized how far the group would go, soon establishing chapters in 45 states, with members eventually indicted on charges ranging from civil disorder to conspiracy in the Washington, D.C. rampage. McInnes had founded what would become, according to the Canadian government, a terrorist entity. At 2:40 a.m., when Fox News decreed that Donald Trump had won, the crowd in the Gaslight erupted. Howling men in MAGA caps hoisted an ebulliant McInnes into the air, crowd surfing him across the throng. But life hadn't been so joyous in the 8 years since he'd left Vice, the Montreal magazine media conglomerate he'd co-founded in 1994 at age 24. He'd lost so much in the intervening years: friends, fistfights, the respect of peers, a stake in Vice Media Group's future profits, presumably countless brain cells. In his departure letter from Vice, he'd vowed his ideas would one day blossom into fruition like 100 humid vaginas in the presence of God's boner. Now, here he was, a legal immigrant from Canada, living in the States on a green card, surrounded by 100 sweaty dudes, some waving cocktail napkin-size U.S. flags. McInnes didn't simply feel vindicated. He believed he was at the pinnacle of a new world. "I feel like Clark Kent," he tweeted. "I'm just a guy in a suit, but if you have a problem, I'd be happy to punch through your face." Interviewed today for this story, he told me that Trump's victory party was one of the greatest nights in my life. In the 1990s, McInnes was hardly a far-right menace. He was a tree-planting vegetarian, a druggy anarchist, and a self-described dogmatic feminist. Some people who knew him then still regard him as one of the funniest people they've ever met. He counted comedians such as David Cross and Sarah Silverman as friends, both of whom contributed articles to Vice. Neither agreed to interview requests. But over time, McInnes accelerated his drift to the political fringe. In 2003, when Vice was largely an extension of McInnes's psyche, Jimmy Kimmel told the New York Times that its brand of humor is what I would do if there were no standards and practices on TV. The whole Vice gestalt was so laced with sarcasm that the Village Voice called it brilliant hipster self-parody. McInnes's early provocations were widely perceived as a commentary on hate, rather than hate itself. When his stance began to grow more blatantly xenophobic, he turned to stand-up, a medium that allowed him to claim he was only joking around. "Just kidding. had long been his default position, but couching his beliefs in humor didn't hide the deadly serious nature of his politics. His true intentions were tattooed right on his back in a tableau depicting a jellyfish with Chiang Kai-shek and Fidel Castro, two immigrants, he once proclaimed, that came into a country, wiped out the previous cultures, and started new, prosperous ones. The days of the West are numbered, and I will be the impetus that destroys it. I am turning America inside out, from the outside in. By 2016, his unseemly pronouncements had become a part of American political discourse. He made an overt statement on his webcast. Can you call for violence generally? 'Cause I am. He also declared, in a textbook example of hate speech, bordering on incitement, fighting solves everything. We need more violence from the Trump people. Trump supporters, choke an MF, going on to use derogatory terms about trans people and women. Get your fingers around the windpipe. The expletive-laden comment was among the reasons he would ultimately get deplatformed from Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter. In November 2018, he reluctantly stepped down as leader of the Proud Boys, but by then, he'd already lit the match and passed the torch. A peer-reviewed Bard College study this year determined that, based on an analysis of his public statements, the rhetoric spouted by McInnes is actually fascist political action. No longer the make-believe insurgent he'd been in his punk days, the Canadian originator of the Proud Boys had become, at 50, his beard specked with gray, a fever dream incarnate of the tattoo on his back. Not unlike his good friend Roger Stone, the Trump crony, and not incidentally pardoned felon, who has Nixon's face emblazoned between his shoulder blades, McInnes wanted to subvert things. He wanted to cause chaos. He wanted to break America and remake it in his beginnings. This account, based on my first-hand observations and interviews with McInnes's friends and former colleagues, as well as McInnes himself, is the forgotten backstory of how a wise-cracking media maverick became a well-known and influential hate-monger, to quote the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. I worked alongside McInnes at the start of Vice in 1994, becoming the magazine's editor shortly after it moved from Montreal to New York in 1999. Though McInnes immediately struck me as someone to avoid outside of work, nothing then indicated he would hatch an organization as vitriolic and violence-prone as the street-brawling Proud Boys. He and I were never friends. Founding editor Suresh Alvi, who remains at Vice Media with the title of founder, brought me on board as a writer at the same time as McInnes. And when I stepped down in early 2001, it was largely because of McInnes's toxic attitude. By then, his title was co-founder. Vice's third co-founder, Shane Smith, was integral to the arc of McInnes's life. He was, before their very public falling out, McInnes's bandmate, roommate, rival, and best friend. Close since the age of 12, they shared everything from mescaline, then the Canadian name for PCP or horse tranquilizer, to lovers. How tight were they? A 2002 book they co-authored, The Vice Guide to Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, claims that McInnes once unwittingly squeezed his penis into the same condom as Smith's during a threesome. Smith today serves as executive chairman of Vice Media. He is considered an internet age pioneer, having expanded an indie magazine into a global powerhouse. He is sometimes referred to as Citizen Shane among certain ex-colleagues, as much for his Hearst-like legacy as a media baron, huckster, and former purveyor of yellow journalism, as for his Xanadu-like home in Santa Monica. In April, Smith's wife, Tamika, filed for divorce, and the mansion was sold for $48.7 million. the approximate amount, according to the Wall Street Journal, that Vice Media lost in 2019. Smith declined to be interviewed for this story. The company provided the following statement to Vanity Fair. Vice and Gavin parted ways in 2008, many years before Gavin founded the Proud Boys. Vice unequivocally condemns white supremacy, racism, and any form of hate, has shown a fearless, bright light of award-winning journalism on extremism, the alt-right, and hate groups around the world, and has created one of the most inclusive, diverse, and equitable companies in media. Our respective records of the last decade and a half speak for themselves. Vice News, in fact, has been unflinching in its extensive and clear-eyed coverage of the Proud Boys. Media executive Nancy Dubuque took up the role of CEO in 2018 after Vice Media began to buckle in the hashtag MeToo era, triggered in part by a New York Times sexual harassment expose in which the founders apologized for the company's detrimental boys club culture. Though neither Smith nor McInnes typically comment on each other due to the terms of a separation agreement, the latter recently told CNN that he still haunts Smith's company like Banquo's ghost. Lies, betrayal, greed. There's a Macbethian whiff to the entangled narratives of McInnes and Smith. But even though Banquo gets sacrificed to the vaulting ambition of Macbeth, his former brother-in-arms, McInnes would seem to have more in common with Coriolanus, a violence for violence's sake fame lord, whose opportunism outweighs genuine political convictions. Shakespearean or not, McInnes started both Vice magazine and the Proud Boys, and one metastasized out of the other. Gavin Miles McInnes was born in England to Scottish parents in 1970. His family immigrated to Ontario when he was five, settling in suburban Ottawa. In high school, he formed a gang called the Monks, with guys nicknamed Pig Owl and Pukey Stallion. Among the dozen-odd outcasts in the crew were McInnes's two best friends, Eric DeGrasse and Steve Durand. As kids, they said McInnes's predominant characteristic was his recklessness. A super-radical shit-disturber, Durand told me, anything to provoke an extreme reaction. Was there any foreshadowing that he would go on to form a group as extreme as the Proud Boys? Gavin was really into making rules that you had to abide by, recalled DeGrasse, explaining that one rule McInnes devised as a teenager has since become codified as a Proud Boys bylaw. The Klan's second-degree initiation rite for adrenaline control involves naming five breakfast cereals while being punched in the arms. The Monks did the same thing. We'd all beat the shit out of you until you could say five breakfast cereals, DeGrasse said. The culture of our gang was that if you were ever earnest or vulnerable, you lost all credibility. McInnes and his Monks were stoner freaks, on a different planet entirely than the Carpies, rural farm lads from up Carp River. Nobody wanted us to show up at their party because we were the guys who started doing drugs, and we'd always F-shit up a little bit, said DeGrasse, then nicknamed Dog Boy. Moving on from bongs, some of the Monks, by age 15, were dropping acid and huffing Pam cooking spray. In 1986, a police officer came to their school to screen a PSA about the dangers of drunk driving. As McInnes relates in his 2012 autobiography, the students at Earl of March Secondary School watched the sobering account of a young woman paralyzed in an accident. During the Q&A that followed, McInnes took the microphone. "Why do you consider being in a wheelchair so horrible?" he asked the officer. "My mother is in a chair and has been her whole life, and our family certainly doesn't see her as some kind of tragedy." This was a lie, but it already revealed his affinity for darkly unfunny identity-based jokes. Even at that early age, he was both a class clown and a very natural manipulator, DeGrasse explained. McInnes, DeGrasse added, would use him and Durand as the fall guys for his jokes when girls were around. We called ourselves the Cardboard Guys because we were just these cutouts that he would use as props for his show. Later in life, several people who became close with McInnes would come to understand a similar dynamic, most notably his two partners at Vice, Smith and Alvey. The origins of Vice can be traced to a rehab facility 30 minutes south of Montreal. In 1994, Alvey was 25 and had been shooting heroin for 5 years. Having OD'd multiple times, he was thieving where he could, pawning gold or cameras to cop his fix. He tried getting clean many times. Nothing worked. Blaming Montreal, it's too decadent of a city, he moved away to Minnesota, Vancouver, even Slovakia. But wherever he went, after the dope sickness wore off, he'd kick, get clean for a little while, and turn to Valium until he could find a dealer, then he'd get strung back out. That spring, Alvey checked into the Foster Addiction Rehabilitation Center, a clinic overlooking a cemetery in Saint-Philippe, Quebec. "If you keep using," they told him, pointing at the tombstones, "that's where you'll end up." 2 years ago, I drove out to Foster with Alvey, where, sitting in a grassy ditch at the graveyard's edge, he recounted the story of Vice's beginnings. Days before entering rehab, Alvey had gone with his family to the mosque to celebrate Eid. As a Pakistani-Canadian, Alvey was raised Muslim, but had never been observant. On that day in the prayer hall, however, he got down on his knees and begged for mercy. "If there's an Allah up there," he prayed, "I need your help, now." He felt a sense of surrender, of submission to Islam. Everything after that started changing quickly. During treatment, the therapist asked the inpatients to do a career exercise, write down their ideal job, imagining a time when they would be sober, and try to reintegrate themselves into society. Alvey described himself working for a magazine somehow, even though he couldn't imagine any media company ever giving him a job. After rehab, he attended a Narcotics Anonymous meeting where a stranger named Walter walked up to him, offering to become his sponsor. Walter asked if he was interested in writing. Alvey nodded, adding that he'd never written before. It didn't matter. The next day, Walter introduced him to two Haitian publishers who were starting a cultural newspaper called Voice of Montreal. The job was part of a government program that supplemented regular welfare checks. Alvey, already on welfare, was hired on the spot. The exercise from rehab had come true. "I wrote that, and Allah made it happen," as he put it. "If I hadn't been a heroin addict, Vice wouldn't exist." He felt that it had all been preordained, that heaven-sent grace was coming his way. "He would think things, and they would happen," he told me. While vacuuming at his parents' house one day, he found himself thinking about a song by Husker Du, the first punk band he'd loved. Knocking the remote with the vacuum cleaner, he accidentally turned on the TV, and the video for that exact song came on. Husker Du had broken up, but the band's frontman, Bob Mould, would soon be performing live in Montreal. Alvey knew his magazine would cover it. He just needed to find someone to review the concert, which is how I ended up writing for Volume 1, Issue 1, A Voice of Montreal. At university in Ottawa, McInnes took women's studies courses and got a female symbol tattoo with an E for equality. He started aligning himself with socially conscious groups. He did it for social currency, as a fashion statement, rather than because he really believed in the ideology, claimed DeGrasse. Around that time, McInnes started a punk band called Leather Ass Buttfuck with his grade school friend Shane Smith. McInnes sang songs like "You Can't Rape a 38," as Smith, attired in leather chaps, banged away at a Flying V guitar. They had this weird bondage element, said Durand, who saw them perform live. There was blood involved. Their shtick was being half-naked, falling down drunk. It was effing gnarly. After university, both McInnes and Smith bummed around Europe. Smith relocated to Budapest, where he became, as he's described it, a criminal, involved in arbitrage, money trading. McKenna stayed in squats and attended a fascist skinhead rally in Germany. "They look great," he wrote shortly thereafter of the skinheads. "Why is it the bad guys always look cool?" Asked today about that experience, he grew agitated. "Are you implying that I somehow became enamored with Nazi skinheads at that rally?" "Not enamored," I replied. "But there was a fascination." "That's a terrible angle," he argued. "Skinheads have always been the bad guys." He vehemently denied any links between skinheads and the Proud Boys, even though Fred Perry polo shirts are worn by both groups, and members of 211 Boot Boys, described by the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, the watchdog organization that monitors extremist and hate groups, as an ultra-nationalist far-right skinhead crew, fought alongside members of the Proud Boys after a McInnes speech in New York City in 2018, singling out left-wing protesters and assaulting them. "It's more of the media's desperate need for Nazis," he insisted over the phone. "We don't allow any Nazis or any kind of racism. We take in these people and we say, we don't care what race you are, as long as you think the West is the best." He kept saying "we" instead of "they." "Gavin," I interjected, "are you still part of Proud Boys?" "No, sorry," he replied. "They do this. They do this." Next photos. Flashback. The author, Adam Leith Gulner, then a vice writer and editor in Montreal, circa 1999. And Vice Admiral McInnes performing with punk band Anal Chinook in Ottawa, 1989, with Vice co-founders Shane Smith and Suresh Alvi in Brooklyn, 2003, celebrating Trump's election night victory in Manhattan, 2016, and a throng at the Capitol on January 6th. After Europe, McInnes moved to Montreal to become a comics illustrator. The city in 1994 was suffering an economic downturn, and cheap rent led to a thriving art scene as well as a strong underground comics movement. McInnes started making his own zine, a photocopied mini-comic called Pervert, about some of his life experiences. I tracked down back issues at Arc Metal, a nonprofit that preserves independent Montreal cultural artifacts. Their archival team was debating what to do with works by McInnes, whom one of them described as the embodiment of smoldering rat shit. When other publications wrote negatively of Pervert, McInnes sent reviewers threatening letters splattered in his blood. Contemporaries in the comics community tried to reason with him. "You need to learn that there is a fine line between humor and offensiveness," explained Ariel Bordeaux of Deep Girl, encouraging him to grow up. Even so, Pervert brought McInnes to Voice of Montreal's attention. Alvi had started recruiting contributors. Local scenester Rufus Rexlanovich thought McInnes could help curate a comics page for the paper. "I introduced Suresh to Gavin, unfortunately," Rexlanovich told me from his home in Texas. "I knew people who Suresh bought drugs with." He emphasized that 90s McInnes had little in common with the person he's become. But even back then, Gavin made an art out of getting on people's nerves. He got off on it. One respected cartoonist from that circle described the Montreal McInnes as already going out of his way to be mean or disruptive. That's why he'd always get punched in the face. He recounted one episode in particular. Standing at a busy intersection at rush hour, the cartoonist noticed McInnes across the boulevard. All of a sudden, to make his friends laugh, he pulled his jacket completely over his head, hockey fight style, and runs blindly into the traffic. Cars in both directions go screech, screech. I thought, for sure, I'm going to see this guy get hit. Luckily, the drivers braked in time and swerved, honking and screaming. His friends were doubling over laughing. "That rings a bell," McInnes commented when I asked him about it. You're not committed to the joke unless you're willing to die to make people laugh. I met Alvy just after turning 18. He was looking for contributors, and when he learned that I wrote for my college paper, he asked me to bring clips to the office. My published output consisted of a political think piece on fascist tendencies in Quebec's separatist party and music reviews, including a write-up of a new album by Husker Du's frontman. At our meeting, Alvy asked if I'd cover his upcoming concert. He couldn't pay for the review, but he could get me in for free, and he offered a token amount to stick around after the show and hand out flyers for Voice of Montreal's launch party. On the night of the performance, I filled my backpack with the rocket-shaped leaflets. Outside the auditorium, a friend told me he'd gotten me a gift to celebrate my first writing assignment. "Close your eyes and open your mouth," he said. He then placed a tab of LSD on my tongue. I'd never done acid. I started peeking during the band's set. The only notes I took were about a made-up song they didn't play called ACID. During the encore, I felt something land on my head. Looking up, I saw what looked like thousands of starry birds fluttering through the concert hall. I soon realized the origami sparrows twirling from the rafters were actually the flyers from my backpack. Someone had opened it, the friend who dosed me, and tossed the contents into the air. The flyers got swept up and dispersed over the crowd. It seemed appropriate. After all, what does a rocket ship do? But as high as I was, I never imagined that Alvy's zine would one day take off too. Afterward, he said it hadn't been a bad way to promote the party, as if God had handed out the flyers. He suggested I write about all of this in my review. It ran in Issue 1, November 1994, as did a feature on LGBTQ+ cinema, a write-up of a playwright exploring immigrant experiences, and an essay on white privilege, which noted that, though advances had been made in multiculturalism, the potential for more insidious racism is nipping at our collective nose. The cover story consisted of a black perspective on the use of the N-word in hip-hop. Over half the issue's writers were women or people of color. At its inception, this was not the lad mag it would one day morph into. Instead, the publication had a clear emphasis on diversity and inclusion. And only one editor was listed on the masthead of the debut issue, Suresh Alvy. For his part, McInnes contributed cartoons and a record review. "I couldn't write," McInnes told me. "I didn't know what writing was. I'd never done it before." Still, Alvy soon hired him as assistant editor. To qualify, McInnes, too, had to be on welfare. Shane Smith didn't join the team until 1995, around the time he wrote a screed celebrating the violence of war. "War is the shit. As addictive and consuming as heroin, war is an invitation to the greatest party of all. The story's moral seemed to hint at things to come. You should fear this. This is the heat of a conflict that burns everything it touches." He'd come to Montreal at the urging of McInnes. They needed help selling advertising, and Bullshitter Shane, as McInnes was known to call him, seemed like a solution. In Ottawa, Smith had been a waiter in a fancy restaurant. "He was always a great hustler," McInnes told me. "He was either broke or he'd have like $3,000 from tips." The night he was introduced to Alvy at a local dive bar, Smith dropped LSD. He kept trying to tell Alvy that they were going to take over the world, but he was tripping so hard that the words would only come out garbled. "I was going, 'I can't get it out, I can't get it out.'" On acid, Smith could already see how their magazine would lift off. The vision for global domination was clear. He just couldn't articulate it yet. Upon Smith's arrival, they shortened the magazine's name to Voice in order to sell ads in other Canadian cities. The masthead soon listed Alvy as editor-in-chief, McInnes as office manager, and Smith as business manager. The three were running things self-sufficiently, so they decided to cut ties with their Haitian publishers, changing the magazine's name yet again, by dropping the O. The name Vice didn't simply mirror its creator's appetites. It also got them press. The founders made up a tale that they'd been forced to switch names because the Village Voice had threatened to sue. The story got picked up by Canadian media. We were in every local paper, every national paper, McInnes has written. The lie just snowballed. Lying became part of who we were. Though they were still essentially a culture zine, Smith brought a focus on good storytelling ability, in other words, being able to lie through your teeth, as one early feature story formulated it. We were all about making up shocking stories, Smith would later explain. It's hard to unravel the truth of Smith's own backstory. He has said, for example, that he grew up dirt poor, but both his and McInnes's father worked at Computing Devices of Canada, a military engineering firm. Their dads helped design a ballistic computer for the M1 Abrams tank used by the U.S. Army. The truth of it is, I always thought I was going to die, because when I was young, I was in a kind of quasi-gang, Smith remarked in an interview with filmmaker Spike Jonze, then the creative director of Vice. There were 12 of us, and then by the time I was 18, 9 had died. This much is certain. Smith attended one of Ottawa's top-ranked high schools, Lisgar Collegiate Institute, as did the late news anchor Peter Jennings and actor Matthew Perry. Smith was already blurring things then. In the school yearbook, he described himself as a real, real rumcully. Rumcully is an arcane pirate word for a rich fool. Smith started enlisting Alvey and McInnes to help with ad sales. He did the same with me. Alongside writing pieces and selling space and distributing the magazine, I also played guitar in Smith's swamp rock band, Ultraviolet Booze Catastrophe. An immense amount of work went into producing each issue, but there was a DIY spirit with everybody pitching in. In 1997, Vice took on a new editor, Robbie Dillon, a bank robber and loan shark who had just been released from Bordeaux prison for drug trafficking. He was enrolled in journalism night classes, where he wrote an article called How to Survive in Prison, which got him the editor gig. Even Dillon was taken aback by Vice's journalistic standards, as he told me recently. Gavin might have been making stuff up, but Shane was making up the rules. I'd say, Shane, you can't write an article about smuggling guns into Ireland. You were never in Ireland. You can't say that this guy said this. He's not even a guy. He'd go, well, can we be sued? I'd go, not if it's not a real guy. And he'd go, okay, we'll do it. Despite his criminal background, Dillon was a solicitous editor who wanted verifiable stories that took readers inside places they wouldn't otherwise be able to access. In McInnes's words, Dillon wrote the only serious content in our magazine for months. The publication became a blend of outright fabrication and almost confessional sincerity. Whatever bile oozes from the hissing bag of snakes inside my skull, as Dillon wrote in one editorial. They started to find their voice by doing, as they often said, stupid stories in a smart way, and smart stories in a stupid way. An interview with a piece of pasta, for example, might explore the philosophical realities of inanimate objects. An article purporting to help readers get laid would be written in binary code. While McInnes and a small coterie wrote the lion's share of the pieces, an array of contributors shaped it, including Amy Kellner, Bruce LaBruce, Leslie Arfin, Derek Beckles, Lisa Gabrielle, Thomas Morton, and photographer Ryan McGinley, who shoots on occasion for Vanity Fair. Their combined voice was a combustible mix. I thought of it as like a hyper-intelligent teenaged valley girl from the 80s, who's read Michel Foucault, explained Jesse Pearson, a former Vice editor. There was a lot of, like, barf-me-out kind of slang, but also a certain intelligence hiding behind it. There was also something else hiding behind it, and that duplicity is what got them to New York when, in 1999, McInnes, Smith, and Alvey pulled off their biggest con to date. During a Montreal newspaper interview, they claimed that a local multimillionaire software entrepreneur named Richard Soswinski wanted to buy Vice. As they tell it, he read the ensuing article and ended up investing $1 million for 25% of the company. Then came the thunder, McInnes told me. 2 years after relocating to Manhattan, he was standing on his roof on the Lower East Side when he saw the second plane hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center. That moment, he said, changed everything for him. 9/11 made me a nationalist and made me a Western chauvinist. Until then, he claimed, he hadn't really cared about politics. But the idea of pinning some newfound chauvinism on 9/11 is inaccurate. He'd already been churning out provocative, race-baiting content before the attacks, even if there was a marked shift in his approach soon after he moved to the U.S. Looking back on his output from that pre-9/11 period, two articles stand out as harbingers. The first is a photo shoot from the fall of 1999, shortly before I became the editor, that shows a multicultural array of male and female models hugging a man in a KKK robe. The section, which billed itself as a 9-page fashion shoot that single-handedly stops all racism forever, was intended to troll readers. It lampooned racism, McInnes told me, but the concept behind it stemmed from a supposed weakness that McInnes immediately detected in his new homeland, America's sensitivity around race. Just as he had done with the monks, he set out to mock what he perceived as a vulnerability, prodding at it in hopes of creating laughs or havoc. The second piece dropped the following year. Written by McInnes, a recent immigrant, it called for closing the borders of the U.S. With lines like, "Everything from deformed frogs to the allergy epidemic can be attributed to overpopulation," it may have seemed like another one of his freaky jokes, but there was nothing funny about it. He had inserted it into the magazine without me having seen it. I was the editor then, but he made many of the final decisions about the magazine's content. Asked about that story today, he claimed that his anti-immigration stance then came from an environmental perspective. In retrospect, none of us, including myself, were innocent bystanders. Some were even enablers. Smith, for his part, would tell Wired in 2007, a year before McInnes' departure, Gavin liked to push buttons, and he got a lot of personal notoriety for dealing with race issues. This is not what we're about. It's never what we've been about. Though the organization's complicity during McInnes' tenure can't simply be waved aside, there's also no way that Vice's management and staff could have seen all that was coming. Part of the failure may be that nobody understood his tactics, even if his politics were hiding in plain sight. In that regard, the circle of people who worked with McInnes and avidly read Vice in that era might be compared to, say, the parts of the culture that long celebrated Woody Allen or Louis C.K., two humorists who achieved fame and fortune even as they openly told us through their work who they were all along. In McInnes' case, he also told us through the work of Vice's contributors, whose words he sometimes changed freely, adding entire paragraphs to writers' articles, according to several sources. He was my boss and the de facto editor-in-chief. Looking back now, I deeply regret not pushing back, especially during my year at the helm. Until that point, McInnes had been, above all, a trickster, a mean clown, as two former associates put it. But with 9/11, many culture critics began to assert that irony was in retreat. And irony, after all, had been Vice's primary register. A change came over the magazine. McInnes, too, became more hawkish. Politically correct words are the result of liberals trying to shape fear and guilt into meaningless syntax, McInnes wrote in 2002. In an unhinged New York Press interview that same year, he uttered homophobic and racist slurs, using the N-word and denigrating Puerto Ricans. Regarding Williamsburg's gentrifiers, he said, at least they're white. With his partners busy expanding the brand and seeking wealth, I was willing to sacrifice happiness for greed, Alvey admitted in 2002. McInnes became increasingly influenced by the writings of Jim Goad, author of the Redneck Manifesto. The greatest writer of our generation, McInnes has said of him. Goad attended the Proud Boys' election night party in 2016. The organization's now-defunct website described a book of his as Proud Boy Holy Scripture. Another writer who made a lasting impression on McInnes was paleoconservative Pat Buchanan, from whose book he has often read aloud at Proud Boys' events. In January 2003, Vice did a The West is the Best issue, inspired by Buchanan's The Death of the West. In that issue, McInnes ran an interview entitled The Merits of War with Scott McConnell, executive editor of Buchanan's magazine, The American Servative. That August, McInnes himself published an MCON piece about his efforts to convert Vice readers to conservatism. I felt like Dr. Frankenstein, he wrote, of his red-pilling campaign, It's Alive. When other media outlets confronted him about the monster he was creating, he brushed it off. I did it for a laugh, telling Gawker that he'd fabricated facts and nobody had caught on. The New York Times ran a feature describing McInnes' views as closer to a white supremacist, a characterization he bridles at today. I love being white. It's something to be very proud of, it quoted him as saying. I don't want our culture diluted. We need to close the borders now and let everyone assimilate to a Western, white, English-speaking way of life. I remember how upset Alvey was whenever we spoke about that article. For him, the son of Pakistani immigrants, the situation seemed particularly noxious. Smith, too, was allegedly furious. Even so, it would take 5 more years for his partners to cut ties with McInnes, which is when things got truly Shakespearean. On meeting the three witches, Banquo wonders whether he has consumed some insane root that takes the reason prisoner. McInnes certainly took a prodigious amount of drugs, especially cocaine, as he's often bragged. Under his leadership, the magazine openly discussed ways to max out your coke high. But the intensification of his far-right views coincides with the time that he started taking another psychotropic drug, Adderall, an amphetamine-based stimulant that helps with focus and is prescribed for ADHD. It can be taken recreationally or to boost productivity, but there are serious consequences if abused. Donald Trump, it is worth noting, has himself weathered unproven allegations of hardy Adderall use. McInnes, who has spoken publicly about taking Adderall to help him write, has dated his use of the drug back to the early 2000s. I didn't take more or less than anyone else, he wrote in an email, and no, it did not affect my writing. But those around him took notice. Adderall is a really big part of the story, alleges a former colleague. He was using a lot of Adderall, a lot. We know what the side effects are. It can lead to grandiosity, to feeling like you are right and the world is wrong. It can include elements of paranoia, and all those psychological phenomena are wrapped up in Gavin's transformation. In one episode of his podcast, McInnes has described procuring Adderall from a Park Avenue doctor. He continued taking the drug after having children with his wife, Emily Gendrasek, whom he married in 2005. The way he describes his stag party, held in upstate New York, gives a sense of how altered his worldview had seemingly become. As relayed in his autobiography, he got upset at his father for not doing cocaine with us. Then, he claims, 10 of his friends dressed up as Klansmen, hoods and all, as they burned a 15-foot wooden cross. Nobody I spoke to would confirm whether this actually happened. McInnes insists in the memoir that its contents are true. By that point, McInnes' Still Advice was also contributing to VDare.com, a site that promoted the work of white supremacists, according to the SPLC. Smith attended the wedding. "I remember him standing there, surveying," Eric DeGrasse recalled. Smith, according to former Vice employees, seemed to know that something, somehow, would need to change. "There was a kind of rivalry there that I think was mainly coming from Shane," said Jesse Pearson, the editor at the time. "That's when it became like a Shakespeare play. These two power-hungry lords fighting for the kingdom." Added another colleague from this period, "the defining aspect of the relationship was their rivalry. They were two trashy dudes in spandex, trying to out-guitar solo each other every night." A decisive turning point came 5 months after the wedding, when McInnes attended the 2006 American Renaissance Conference, a racial realist meetup that attracted hundreds of white nationalists. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.